I also wanted to let you know that Volatility has modules that allow you to scan the registry of the system. That, of course, is useful, especially if you're looking to understand whether malware is trying to establish persistence on the infected system. You need to do that in several steps. First, you need to use the hive scan command to locate where in memory are the registry hives loaded. Now, the registry is stored on the file system, but also is loaded in memory. And in fact, the version as memory is more up to date because some of the stuff in memory maybe wasn't yet flushed to the file system. You run it with hive scan to locate the offset where the registry is loaded into memory. It gives you several offsets. Any one of them will work. You can pick any one of them and then say hive list and then provide one of the offsets that you got from hive scan. And now it's going to be showing you all the major registry hives. If you're looking for HK local machine software, etc., run, you're looking for software, because that's where the run registry key is. So here I located it, and then I can actually scan it. I need to supply the offset where it was located. This was the offset, so it's a third step that I need to follow. It doesn't matter. It's documented in your book. There are three steps you need to follow. The goal is to look at contents of the registry. And I noticed that Windows current version run contains this entry that is suspicious. It doesn't exist on most Windows systems. So as you can see, you can scan the registry using Volatility. There are three steps involved, as documented in your book. The steps are a little bit manual, but if, for those of you who like automating this sort of stuff, you could just parse the output and automate. The last command, just to bring to your attention, all of this I was using Volatility for to actually find it in memory. The last command is actually a Perl script called rip.pl that extracts the necessary information from the registry. There were, yes. So, a good question. Let me show it to you on the screen. So I'm on page 186. So I'm going to say Volatility, hive scan, dash F, media, CD-ROM, unknown. And it's showing me all these hives that are in registry. Guess what? It doesn't matter which one of these I pick. Any one of them will work. That's just how it is. Any one will work. So you don't need to pick an interesting one. Any one of these will work. And now I can pick any one of them. I just picked the first one, and I said hive list dash O, and then I gave it one of the offsets, which in this case I picked 0x27FEB60. And now that I found software, it's somewhere in here, there it is, and I noticed where it's located, 1661EC, etc., then I use rip.pl, well, to locate software in the file, media, CD-ROM, unknown, and the format is a little strange. I need to give it the @ and then type in there this offset, which happens to be 0xE161E6B8. And now I'm dumping the registry, and I can look at it and examine it. All right, so just to summarize this little exercise, look at all the stuff we were able to pull out of memory. And we didn't even have to look at the code much. This can be fast. This can be automated. We found a hidden process. That suggests to us that it's a rootkit. We identified the process ID. We were able to dump it. We noticed that it injected some code into explorer.exe, and we were able to extract that DLL as well. We found an outbound connection that was meant to be concealed from us. We found that this was a bot with IRC capabilities just by looking at its strings, and we found that it sets a certain autorun registry key. Very useful findings, and you can get this just in a few minutes of analysis. That's the wonderful thing about memory forensics. But there is more, as I wanted to show you in the upcoming examples. Right now, though, I wanted to show you the essential aspects of volatility and also to explain to you that volatility really takes care of all the nitty-gritty details about how the memory is structured. It just gives you the modules you can use to find the information you want. Yes? So you're saying, when would you want to do memory-based analysis as opposed to, say, behavioral analysis using something like CaptureBAT? Well, some people prefer to use one or the other. For example, what I just showed you lends itself very well to automation. So all of this could be scripted. CaptureBAT could be scripted too, but this is a little bit easier. Also, the biggest advantage is that CaptureBAT would be fooled if we were dealing with a rootkit. This thing, we don't care if it's a rootkit. In fact, we like it when it's a rootkit because the fact that it's a rootkit shows us certain discrepancies that allow us to find malware even easier than if it weren't a rootkit. So especially when you're dealing with rootkits is when this technique is useful. But there's additional information available in memory that you can use to speed up memory analysis. So I wanted to use another example to show you the wonderful things you can get, the context of the infection that's available for you in memory. And this is particularly useful not when you infect your own laboratory system, but when actually as part of incident response you're able to capture memory of the actual infected system. And that's the example we're going to use. Now in this example called lab1.exe, I do have the executable that was found on the compromised system, but I was also fortunate in that the incident responder captured memory of the infected box before the box was rebooted, which nowadays, you know, not a lot of incident responders know to do that. They end up just trying to reboot the system. So we have the memory image, and I gave it to you. It's in lab1.image. And you can, if you scan it with PSList, you will notice our sample running in clear text. Lab1.exe is running right there. You can even try to dump it out of memory using procdump by its process ID because it's not hidden. You see process 1172. But if you try to do that, you will get some output. However, you will also get these warnings or error messages. Memory not accessible. Why is that? Well, we're looking at a memory image, but you see, some things are not actually in memory. You realize that, of course, you might have 1 gig of RAM, but maybe you're running lots of programs. The rest of the RAM is virtualized and is actually stored on the file system in a page file. And Windows, it's normal for it to put things into a page file all the time as it continues to run and tries to manage memory. So you don't have the page file as part of your memory capture. So some pages, some chunks of memory will not be accessible to you. So we tried to dump this process, but some of it wasn't accessible. So we're missing some chunks of data or some chunks of code when we dump it from memory. That's one big limitation of doing proc dump. We just don't have it. It's somewhere in the page file. We don't have access to it. That shows you a limitation of purely analyzing the extracted executable. I mean, not only do you need to try to rebuild its headers if it doesn't run, but it might not be runnable because you're actually missing chunks of it from memory. But in this incident, we actually do have the executable that the incident responder gave to us from the file system. So let's try to do a bit of analysis for you. I'm going to show it to you on my screen. Revert to when my system is still clean. And I do have this malicious executable in your malware folder. Day 5. Lab 1. Here's that malicious executable that was grabbed from the file system under the infected system. I'm going to load it into OrlyDebug. Remember OrlyDebug? Let's see. My exceptions are ignored. My hide OD is enabled. Good. And I'm just going to load it. Does anybody recognize? I know it's a little hard to see. Anybody recognizes anything on top there? We've seen something very, very similar. Notice FS0. It's good old SEH. It's actually using the packer that we've already seen. If you might recall that this is pcompact. If you just try to run this program, in fact, I can just try running it even outside of the debugger. Look at what happens. Just by itself. Please enter password. It's a password protected program. If I don't know the password, it won't run. Malware can do that, especially if the victim was infected. Let's say if there's some social engineering, the victim was asked to type a password, or maybe incidents of the infection are a little bit different. This thing is password protected. No matter how good you are at dumping programs from memory, this thing won't even extract itself unless you type the password. I don't know what the password is. It won't run. Application corrupt. How do we deal with this? Now, we already know how to unpack this program, kind of. Remember? I'll remind you. I'll show it to you on the screen. We ended up executing this a little bit. And then we set a breakpoint on the stack. Actually, you know, just let me restart to make sure I'm doing this. So let's see. So we follow the stack. We set the memory access breakpoint, hardware, D word. Then we ran the program with the expectation that it's going to start cleaning up the stack, right? I hit the memory breakpoint once. It's not unpacked yet. Hey, it's asking me for a password. Right? It won't unpack itself until I give it the password. And the password must be between 4 and 74 characters long. It's password protected. I'm stuck. What do I do? Well, we have the memory image. And if the victim typed the password into this box, maybe that password is still in memory. Memory is a bizarre and strange thing. Sometimes things are left there even though somebody tried to not use them anymore. Remember the example I gave you of OpenSSL passwords remaining in memory? So this is an example where having that context of the infection is particularly useful. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm actually not going to use a fancy tool. All I'm going to do is look at strings embedded in memory. And what I'm going to search for are strings like password protected. Please enter password. PE Compact version 2. I'm looking for strings, and I'm going to look for strings like this, and I'm going to look for any data that surrounds those strings, because maybe that's where the password that the user entered is stored. It sounds like a very basic technique. So I mean, strings, how simple is that? But it really works to show you the context of infections like this. And to search for strings, this is a large file. It's a big memory image file. You can search it using strings. You can search it using a hex editor. Yes. So in this case, the password is actually the decryption key. Yeah. So it's not like we can just find the jump and pretend like we accepted the password. If you try to do that here, it won't work. This particular packer actually uses the password as the decryption key. Yeah, so, I mean, you could look for flaws in the decryption algorithm, but, you know, that takes us to a whole new level. Yeah. Yes. Doesn't it have to compare the password to a known value? Well, remember, we're not authenticating to anything. In this case, this is the decryption key. So the way a lot of serious decryption works is that if you don't have the password, you won't be able to recover the original data. Just like when we're looking at obfuscated JavaScript files, an obfuscation key was the last modified date. If we didn't know the date, we couldn't decrypt it. Same thing here. You gotta know the password to unpack this particular program. So you're encrypting it. It'll try to decrypt it. It'll decrypt it with the wrong key. You definitely can try to reverse engineer the decryption algorithm. But you know, that can be pretty hardcore. I mean, that can be very time consuming. So of course, you've got crypto analysts that know how to attack cryptography, but that's a very specialized skill set, hard to come by, and it's also very time consuming. I'm looking for shortcuts. Memory forensics will let me do this kind of shortcuts. So let's take a short break. I would ask you to please, let's take a 5-minute break and then come back. There's actually a lot I want to cover today. I want to make sure we have time to go through it. So let's grab, if you need to go to the bathroom, if you need to grab some snacks, You know, come back. There's ice cream waiting for you. And let's resume in about 5 minutes. So let's continue. Let's get going. There's some fun stuff I wanted to cover here. And as I described earlier, there's some useful information in memory that can speed up our analysis process. Anything we can do to speed up the analysis process is a good thing. And sometimes it's looking for things using strings can be very helpful. Now, it's nice to be able to look at strings using a hex editor, and some good hex editors will be able to parse large files without any problems. And the reason it's nice to look for things in a hex editor is because it's easy for you to see the context within which a string is discovered. And this hex editor that I like is called Hex Editor Neo. There's a commercial version of it that gives you some extra features, but even the free version of Hex Editor Neo is pretty nice. And one of the reasons I really like it is that it's one of the hex editors. Not all of them can do this. It can search for not just Unicode or ASCII. It searches not only for ASCII, but also Unicode strings. And you know what? I looked for an interactive hex editor for Linux that can search for Unicode strings. I haven't been able to find anything. So this is a nice interactive hex editor. It runs on Windows. And there's a drop-down that says, do you want to search for Unicode or ASCII? And remember, if you're looking for strings, don't just search for Unicode or just ASCII. Search for both. So in this case, I'm searching for password protected. Why? Because that was one of the strings within the dialog boxes. So I searched for password protected. I searched for it in ASCII. Now I'm searching for it in Unicode. And here I found it in memory. In fact, next to it is also, please enter password. Password must be between... Okay, not all that useful just yet. Let's do some more searches for other strings. You can search using strings, and here's how I typically do that. By default, Unix strings will search for ASCII. So I'm searching my memory image, and I'm grepping for interesting strings. Right now, in this example, I'm searching for PE Compact, because that was in the dialog box. But I don't just want to find PE Compact. I want to find a few strings that are above and a few strings that are below it. So the way I do it is I extract all ASCII strings, and I grep for this interesting string, PE Compact, in this case. And I also want to show two lines after it and two lines before. Grep lets you do that. And look at what I find. Here's PE Compact, but there isn't really anything around it that's useful. How about Unicode? To search for Unicode using strings, dash dash encoding equals L. This is not a 1, this is a lowercase L. I see it again. In fact, cancel, that looks like part of the cancel dialog box. You see all of that information is in memory. Whatever dialog windows were visible is in memory. That's pretty handy. Now, you need to search for a bunch of stuff. I don't know what I'm searching for. I'm just poking around. I'm hoping I'm going to come across something that's interesting, something that's useful. And here's what I did. What I searched for, in this case, was lab1.txt. That's the name of my executable. And I outputted the result into a text file, and look what I found. I found lab1.txt, but also surrounding it was /. That suggests to you the full path where the file was launched from. And look at this, removable disk E. Hey, that's interesting. That's context. What does this mean? Well, it looks like maybe the infection vector was a USB key. If it was located on the E drive, and E is a removable disk. That's already giving you something. Now, you've got, you know, maybe look at your video camera footage to see who is approaching the system. I mean, if it's a server, maybe somebody entered the server room. That's good stuff. I also searched for lab1. Now, in this case, I searched for Unicode strings. Now I'm searching for ASCII strings. And look what I came across. I mean, this is great. It looks like these are instructions. Auto runs, insert USB drive, auto runs should execute run, if Autorun is turned off, then open USB drive in Windows Explorer and manually execute. When prompted for a password, copy and paste the following. This will take a long time to brute force. Hey, this is great. It looks like what probably happened is there was somebody who walked up to the system with a USB key, inserted the USB key, and I imagine this was an unsophisticated computer user. We can come up with all sorts of scenarios. Maybe this is cleaning crew that comes into the office at night and somebody got paid to insert this and follow directions to infect the system. So, hey, let's try. This will take a long time to brute force. That's going to be our password. So, of course, I left this running on my system for too long. I'm going to reboot. Oh, there it is. So now, if I'm unpacking this, if I think I know the password, this will take a long time to brute force. And now I actually reached my hardware breakpoint. Remember this one? This might look to you familiar. It's the same process that we followed before. We can actually now continue. We can take a jump. We can dump it from memory. And now the program has been unpacked, and we can actually do some analysis on it. So I'm not going to really go through this now, because if you want to, well, you've got the instructions in your book. And also, I have the unpacked version of this in your malware folder. My point is that sometimes the easy way out is to just do some string searches for context. And in this case, of course, I picked this example to illustrate that point very bluntly. You've got a password. There's all sorts of things in memory, all sorts of treasures that you can find there. And you can search for strings. You know, strings works. Also, if you use the sleuth kit for forensic analysis, it has a script called search strings that can look for strings. And also, if you like Radare, it is that tool that I told you that's a Unix-based command line hex editor. You can search for ASCII and Unicode strings in there. If you like that sort of thing, you've got instructions in your book. So now, I showed you how to unpack it. It's not all that useful for us to try this in the lab because we already dealt with pcompact. I taught you how to unpack this yesterday. And you can follow those exactly same instructions, except that now you will need to type in the password before the unpacking process continues. We unpacked lab1.exe, and now we can actually try to analyze it to see what it's like. Any questions about this process that I just described? Yes. What are the chances of this process being close to the dialog bugs, the actual password itself? It really depends. The reason I say it really depends is because right now we're scanning through memory, and we're scanning through a dump of the physical memory. And in physical memory, things can be all over the place. Usually related things are going to be similar to each other if they're small. If they're large, they couldn't be split into pages, and pages can be all over the place. So that's why when you looked at contents of the dialog box, those strings were near each other. If you look for a password in the proximity of the process itself, a little bit unpredictable. That's where you're looking at larger memory chunks that could be all over the place. But the nice thing about strings is that we're just looking for interesting strings, and in many cases it gives you something useful to look at. So we learned how to examine memory images using volatility, but also I wanted to remind you not to forget something as simple as strings. It can give you useful context. Now what I want to do next is show you how memory forensics can be used to not only analyze what malware can do, but to also determine what malware was used for. In this case, of course, I'm assuming that you got a memory image of the actual infected system. And in many cases, that memory image will contain artifacts that can help you determine how that malware was actually used. For this example, I'm going to continue using Laboratory 1, but in this case, I've got it already unpacked. I called it Lab1 Unpacked. So we unpacked it already. You got an unpacked version of it on your malware folder if you don't feel like unpacking it yourself. And now let's say we want to continue the analysis to see what can this thing do. Well, what we would do is we would load it into a disassembler, we would load it into a debugger, and let me show you a few things that I picked up within this executable. What I'm showing you here is the zoomed out view of IDA Pro, the commercial edition, but you can see something similar in the picture view in the freeware. It shows you the flow of execution of the program. Every time there's a jump, it'll show that to you as an arrow. And look at the image that I'm pointing to right here. You see there's a block of code, but then this block of code could branch into all sorts of different directions. It could execute this one or this one or this one or this one. Usually that indicates that it's a big if statement. If a value is X, it's going to do one thing. If a value is Y, it's going to do another thing. In many cases, in C, you would implement this using a switch statement. It's similar to a nested if statement. And in fact, if you looked at the assembly code that was in this block of code, you would see that actually, indeed, there is a switch statement, and it checks some value for the numeric value. It checks some variable for the value 0 or 1 or 2, etc. I'm just showing you a short excerpt. These are comments automatically inserted, but by IDA Pro actually. So IDA Pro is able to automatically determine that this is a switch statement, and it tells you that there are 6 possible cases. It's going to check that variable for 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4. So in some cases, this indicates that the program can accept multiple commands. Remember, we looked at the IRC server. In that case, the commands were strings. In this case, maybe the commands are numbers. And of course, if you wanted to do some static analysis, you can look at the code that is responsible for handling every one of these potential commands. You could see what it does. But in this case, what I did is I just looked at the names. I looked at the names embedded into the executable to see what API calls it's making. And hey, this should be already familiar to you. Internet open W, internet read file. What's that for? Internet connectivity, right? It's got a way to communicate with something using HTTP usually, especially because of internet read file. Is debugger present? Hey, looks like it's going to have some anti-debugging capabilities. Now, if you want to see how it uses internet open, remember how to do that. I hope you press enter there, or you say find references, and it'll show you the calls that we already went over. When was that? Oh boy, that was yesterday. We looked at Blinky, for example, internet open, internet connect, HTTP open. It seems to be being able to connect to a web server. What's the web server, by the way? MyCNN.com. Without a dot between my or CNN. Any questions about this? We've covered this already. This is a process of looking at API calls to determine what the program is trying to do. And this is a very common pattern for malware that is able to communicate with a malicious web server over HTTP. Any questions? All right. So far, if you're doing this as part of your forensic analysis or incident response, what would you tell the organization that was infected by this? You know what? Look at your proxy logs or network logs if you have them. Any connections to mycnn.com would probably be suspicious. If you use the proxy server, that'd be great because that would tell you a lot. So already, by just looking at the executable this way, we get a sense for what we might be able to do to scope out this incident. But there's something else that you might be able to find if you actually looked at the strings. Let me show this to you in my lab. And some of you who'd like to follow along, of course, you're welcome to do that. So I'm looking at a dumped version of this. I already have it in the five folder. It's called lab2. Lab2.zip. Contains lab1-unpacked. And I loaded it into OliDebug, and just even without running it, I pressed Control N, and I located those API calls. right? And I looked at where they're located. But also, I can right-click on it, and I just want to look at strings. You could extract them using bintex if you want to. In this case, I right-clicked and I said, find all referenced text strings. And I can look at the various text strings that are in there. I can scroll up and down to see if there's anything meaningful. And look at what I find on the top. Less than, exclamation mark, dash, dash, and dash, dash, greater than. These are HTML comment tags. If you wanted to insert a comment into an HTML file, you would enclose them with within these tags. And in that case, the browser won't show you whatever is in the comment. Some malware, if this is a bot or any other kind of malware that retrieves its instructions from the attacker, from the web server, the attacker will use a compromised web server, but he will enclose his commands within the compromised web server's webpage in comments. So the normal visitors won't see the commands. So when I see this, that's what comes up to my mind. Also, if you scroll a bit further, there's the string ABCD. Well, it's the alphabet string, all the way until 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 9, and a plus sign and a greater than sign. Some of you maybe have seen this before. You can encode text using base 64. You know, base 10 is when we use 10 different digits. Base 64, we use 64. It's not uncommon to see stuff encoded in base 64. And the way to decode it is that normally you use this translation table. So if you're looking at malware and you've got this long string within the malware, that's an indication that some of its text or some kind of data will probably be encoded using base 64. Those are just some observations we can make by simply looking at these strings. But of course, if you want, you can actually see how the program uses a string like the comment string. You can click on it, you can press enter, and it'll take you to the code that makes use of the string. And if you wanted to, you can actually examine it and step through it. But I'm not going to do that, because I'm just going to take these as educated guesses, that this is something that is worth for me to look for in the memory image of the infected system. Because in this exercise, I gave you another memory image of another infected system in the same enterprise, and that infected system was actually used by the attacker. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look in the memory of that infected system for anything that matches HTML comments. Because maybe then I will see not only what the program can do, and it looks like it is able to accept commands from the attacker within HTML comments, but maybe within the memory of that infected system, I will actually be able to see which commands the attacker supplied. Make sense? All right. Well, how do I do that? Again, plain old string search. For this example, I'm using lab 2. And I'm scanning the memory image for, well, the comment delimiter. And this produces a whole lot of output. And I'm just going to take some time to look through it, and let me show you what comes up. So, in this case, I'm on page 220. So I'm going to say strings from media, CD-ROM. I'm looking at lab 2, that image this time, and I'm going to grep dash A2, dash B2, because I like seeing context. Show me two lines before and two lines after the comment. Now, you know what? There could be lots of these strings in the memory of a heavily used system. That's okay. You know, maybe I'll save this to a text file. All right? So I'm going to scan. This could take a while. I mean, it's a large memory image. It's doing a lot of scanning. And let me show you what I found when I did this. Look at this. So there was a lot of junk in there, but I also found these encoded strings in there. And if you take these strings and you decode them using base 64, you actually get stuff like command slash C del 201. Or this one decodes to a number. Now, I wasn't sure what the number was. I poked at it this way and that. But if you interpret this number as an epoch time, that's Unix time starting from, when was it? 1970-something? There's a function to interpret this as time. This translates into 4th of February 2010. How did I translate it from base 64? You can write your own translator. There's some free tools on the web. You paste in this text, it'll translate it for you. And also Mozilla has a decoder for base 64. That's what I ended up using here. So look at what we're able to see. We did a bit of analysis of the strings in the malware sample, and now we're looking within memory to identify interesting stuff. Base 64, how did we know to decode it with base 64? Because we saw that string in memory. So it looks like we may be able to parse these and translate these to maybe get a sense for the commands that the attacker executed on the compromised system. This equals equals is also usually part of base 64. Where is that? Yeah, like this sort of stuff is always seen as part of base 64. Yeah. So pretty cool. In this case, now, I had some help in creating this lab, by the way. I can't take full credit for this. There are some guys who helped me put this together. And we created a script so that you don't have to actually parse this memory image, extract the comments, and automatically decode them. And you're welcome to try them. This is in your day 5 within lab 2. Let me show you. All right, so I'm going to go into malware, day 5, unzip lab2.zip. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to execute the script. It's a Python script, lab2. And this thing was created to automate the manual process that I just showed you. I'm going to parse that memory image to extract all strings that look like HTML comments and decode them using base 64. You're welcome to try this in your lab too. Now it'll take a while to run. I mean, it's a big image file. There's a lot of strings to parse there. This script is within the zip file called lab2.zip. You want to save its output to a text file, and you should be able to see the results. But depending on how much RAM you got, it might take as much as 5 minutes to run. It's a slow script. Let me know if you got any questions so far about what we're doing. Now, it's a fun experiment to go through, just kind of trying to get to the bottom of this particular incident. But to generalize this, what we're doing is we're going back and forth between analyzing the malware sample and looking at the context within which it exists in memory of the live infected system. Or, I'm sorry, of the infected system that was live when we took the image. So this script is in lab2.zip, and I'm scanning lab2.image. It's a new image file that I'm scanning, not the one that was scanned before. You could have done this by hand, I guess, but it would take a lot of time. So it's nice to have some scripting skills. Or to know a friend who has scripting skills. So let me show you, while you're running this, the output that was produced. Some of these are numbers. Some of these are ASCII strings. But remember the switch statement, it looked for numbers. It looked like numbers were commands. So here's an ASCII string, cmd move udp.txt to svc host. Now, where did udp.txt come from? We don't know. Maybe the theory is that maybe for command is a download command or an upload command. But here's something else. The attacker is executing, for, it looks like for is execute. The attacker is executing svchost.exe. So this udp.txt was moved to svchost, and then svchost was executed -s-r. Now, some of you, if you do a lot of incident response, or if you do a lot of auditing, you maybe have sr might look familiar to you. But even if it doesn't, look at another command, pwdump.txt. Pwdump, password dump. And if you do some web searches on password dumps and like S-R, There's a pretty popular tool for dumping hashes on Windows systems. It's called FGDump. And if you want to dump the passwords of a Windows box after you've compromised it, you type FGDump-S-R. So you need to do, right, you don't have a lot of information here. You do some educated guessing. You do some web searches. But most likely what happened is the attacker used this malware to upload to the infected system a copy of FGDump. It was renamed to svchost.exe. And then the files, the hashes were dumped, and the attacker is trying to copy them out. Now, right now, just some educated guesses, but it looks pretty promising. Now you could go back to the infected system and confirm whether or not these commands indeed could be executed in the way that we just described. Now, here's the thing. If the attacker indeed supplied to the infected system a copy of FGDump, then could it be somewhere in memory still? If it recently executed, even if the process finishes running, sometimes its artifacts still remain in memory. So let's look for it. Now the thing is that if this is something like a big file, we cannot simply look at it using strings and scan the whole image file for it. That's because a large file will be split up into little chunks, little pages, and it could be sprinkled across the large memory image dump. These commands we could see by themselves because they're relatively small. But we can't just scan memory directly for the file and expect to find it. But here's what we need to do. Before I explain to you why this works, let me explain to you how memory is tracked. It's something that I already mentioned earlier. Windows Memory Manager abstracts all of these details from us. There's a lot of memory out there to keep track of. And so in reality, the way memory is laid out, the process doesn't really know. The process is oblivious to the challenges of memory management. It thinks on a 32-bit platform that it has 4 gig of memory all to itself. But in reality, these 4 gig could be sprinkled all over physical memory. So if we want to look at memory the way a process looks at it, we really need to do a little bit more work than simply look at strings scanning the whole physical memory dump file. Like, this is a lot of memory to keep track of. That's why things get sprinkled around. So, if you look at the full memory dump, large files could be fragmented and spread across the memory dump. But what if we want to look at files, DLLs that were loaded into a process or that were somehow present within the process's memory? The way you need to do it is to dump the memory image of a particular process. You see, the process thinks that the world is very orderly. So if you want to see what that process sees, instead of scanning the whole physical memory dump, scan just the image of a particular process, and in that case, things will be much more orderly for you. And here's what we're going to do. If we're looking for this particular executable, FGDump, and we think that maybe it will exist within the memory of the malicious process because that's the process that downloaded the executable, then we need to dump memory of that particular process. Does it make sense why we might see it that way? Because that process's memory will be nicely organized and things will be contiguous. If we try to look for this executable in the physical memory dump, we won't find it because it'll be in little chunks all over the place. So, how do you dump memory of a process? There's a plugin for that. Memdump. So what I'm going to do is run volatility pslist to list my processes, and then when I find the process that looks malicious, I'm going to dump its memory using memdump. And then I can scan its memory for interesting artifacts. So as you can see on page 231, here's what I did. Let me show it to you first, and then I'll give you a few minutes to try this. So volatility, oops, remember, I got to be in the volatility directory itself. Volatility, I'm telling it, in this case, I'm not dealing with a rootkit as far as I can see. I'm just going to do pslist. List my processes, media, CD-ROM, lab2. So I'm listing the processes, and actually the malicious process is easy for me to see. It's called lab1.exe. and its process ID is 1172. Now that I know the process ID, I can dump its memory. Volatility, memdmp. Dash p supplies the process ID, 1172, and I gotta supply the path to the memory image file. And now we wait. So what this is this actually parses memory of the process, and it will dump memory the way the process saw it. So it depends on what you mean by physical memory. This is going to be nice and organized. This is going to be the same thing that you see in OLED debug when you press Control M or Alt M. I think you're referring to the fact that sometimes data might not be in memory because it was paged out to disk. And you're right. In that case, I won't find it in there, yes. But the good news is that modern systems have a lot of RAM. I mean, okay, maybe that's an argument. They usually have plenty of RAM so that these programs that are not very big, yes, some of the stuff will be paged out, but if this program was actively running right now, then there's a good chance that most of its pages will be there. And in my experience, yes, a few pages here and there what might be missing if I got really, like in most cases, but most of the stuff will be in memory. Because, I mean, just modern Windows just requires you to have a certain amount of RAM. And you can push it to its limits, but usually this is not a huge problem. It's something to be aware of that, yes, you might be missing some stuff, but usually you gotta get really unlucky if you're gonna be missing most of the stuff. Yes. So whatever was paged out would be missing indeed, but at least most of the stuff should be visible. So if I were to look at memory map using only debug, this is the case, this is a similar kind of view that memdump gets. Nice, organized, everything right next to each other. Well, thank you for bringing it up. So I mentioned to you that most memory dumping tools won't touch the page file, and you're going to be missing some data that happens to have been paged to disk. The only memory dumper that I found that does not have the problem is a commercial tool from HB Gary called FastDump. Yes. FastDump is smart enough to actually be able to grab the stuff that used to be paged and incorporate it into the resulting dump file. Unfortunately, A, it's a commercial tool, and B, the memory image that option produces is incompatible with most other memory analysis tools. Yeah. So unfortunately, the good news is that tool can take care of this problem. It can incorporate whatever was paged into the dump file. But if you use it that way, it gives you only a proprietary dump format, and you have to use HB Gary's tools to analyze it. So you won't be able to analyze the result with volatility, which is too bad. Yeah. But thanks for bringing it up, because if this turns out to be a big problem for you, then you know what? It's great to know that there's at least a commercial tool to deal with the problem. Yeah.